Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Anne Holsinger, Managing Director of the Death Penalty Information Center. Our guest today is Anthony Graves. Mr. Graves was exonerated from death row in Texas in 2010 and has become an advocate for criminal justice reform. He created the Anthony Graves Foundation, which has done work on a variety of criminal justice issues. He has testified before the United States Senate on prison conditions, and he is the author of Infinite Hope: How Wrongful Conviction, Solitary Confinement, and 12 Years on Death Row Failed to Kill My Soul. Mr. Graves, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
To start, could you please briefly tell our listeners about your case and what led to your wrongful conviction and eventual exoneration?
Yeah, of course. So back in 1992, a horrible crime had taken place in this small county. An entire family was murdered. It was shot, stabbed, plunging to death. Gasoline was poured all over their bodies, and the house was burned down in an obvious attempt to cover up the crime. And so this county had no more than about 3,000 people in it. So this was like the first time something like this happened, and that was outrage. So matter of fact, the mayor of the small county came out the next day and said whoever had done the crime didn't deserve a trial. They should be caught and just hanged, right? So like a week later, that's how they proceeded with the case, because the funeral had taken place in the small county. And there were like Texas Rangers were at the funeral. And a young man showed up with gauze wrapped around his head and his hands as though he had been in a fight. He immediately became a person of interest to the Texas Rangers. After the funeral, they followed him home, asked if they could talk with him. He agreed. They took him to the DPS office, and that's where everything began to change. They interrogated this man over 14 hours and called him everything but the child of God, and ended up telling him that they know he hadn't done the case by himself, and they wanted him to give the name of someone who had done it with him. This young man thought he had seen him in a Jeep as they were taking him into the DPS office. He thought he'd seen him in a Jeep with three other guys. So when they asked him for a name of someone, he called my name, and they asked him to tell the story of what happened. He gave them like seven stories. Afterwards, they turned around and arrested this young man, charged him with capital murder. And then they came the next door to my house, picked me up, took me to the local jail, and charged me with capital murder. And that began my nightmare. I ended up being wrongfully convicted because the young man that lied on me ended up falsely testifying against me in trial, even though we never knew that he had been telling the prosecutors that I was innocent. They used his wife against him. They arrested his wife, charged her with capital murder, put her in jail for 2 months, and then let her out on a PR bond and told her to keep going forward. Otherwise, you know, there was no statute of limitation on capital murder. And so because of that, they got him to continue to tell the lie that he initially told. That led to my wrongful conviction. So I had a rogue prosecutor who was just seeking a conviction at any cost. And I had a young man who lied on me to protect his wife because they threatened to go after his wife with capital murder if he didn't continue to tell the story that he told against me. That led to my wrongful conviction, 18 and a half years of prison, two execution dates on death row. All of that because a young man told a lie and a prosecutor wanted a conviction.
Wow, that's awful. What were the circumstances that eventually led to your exoneration?
Great people, great attorneys, great advocates. When a young lady who was a freelance journalist had came to visit me on death row, she wanted to know my story. And when I told her my story, she was just so blown away. She reached out to the Innocent Project and told them, hey, I think you guys need to investigate this case. What a lady there by the name of Nicole Caceres and her students. She was a journalist professor at the time. They was at a death penalty clinic, and they were talking about my case. And the professor had said that, you know, my case was on the fast track, the execution, but it had never really been properly investigated. And he asked everybody who would like to investigate the case, just, you know, sign out what's going on with the case. And this professor that was sitting out there with her student, she said they all looked around and nobody had raised their hand, so they all raised their hand. And once they raised their hand, you know, that just changed my life, changed my faith, because they got involved in my case and they started just really getting in, leaving no stone unturned, and actually concluded that I was innocent. Then they came and visited me on death row. Once they came to visit me and asked me if I had anything to tell them, I said I didn't want to sit here and try to convince you that I was innocent. You know, if you want to really do the work, you'll find that out. And then they told me that I already had been on my case. And they believed in my innocence. And that just good people, good advocates, people that believed in justice and just faith. It all worked in my faith.
What was your experience like immediately after you were exonerated? Were there resources available to help you transition back to life outside of prison?
No. Maybe it was on paper. I don't know. But that was nothing for me, except for my family and the supporters that I had before I come home. I mean, I remember my first few months. I didn't know if I could make it out of here. I mean, I was dealing with mild PTSD and didn't really know it. All I know, I was hypersensitive. I cried a lot. People thought I was doing well, but at nighttime, they didn't see that I was on my balcony crying 2:33 in the morning because I couldn't sleep. I didn't have no routine. I didn't have no friends. I didn't have nothing. I had to start all over from scratch. It was overwhelming at times. But because I had great friends, I had family, they were there for me to lean on. But I remember a lot of dark nights and dark days when I first came home, because there was nothing there in place for me to kind of lean on except for my family and friends.
Earlier, when you described your case, you mentioned that this prosecutor was seeking a conviction at any cost. Eventually, his misconduct actually led to him being disbarred in 2015. And even though prosecutorial misconduct is a leading cause of wrongful capital convictions, it's rare for a prosecutor to face professional consequences like he did. What do you think set him apart?
Me and my pursuit for justice, because at that time when he wrongfully convicted me, there was no provision in the statute of limitations laws that says that you could go after a prosecutor after, you know, you find out you've been wrong for conviction until it can be resolved. The statute ran for 7 years. And if you hadn't been able to bring a grievance for 7 years, again, then the statute of limitations run out. But when I came home, because my case was so egregious, they amended part of that statute to let it run where you could now file a grievance against the prosecutor up to 4 years after you've been released, right? So in that time frame, I was able to take advantage of that new provision in the law that allowed me to file a grievance against the prosecutor that did this to me. That led to hearing, which eventually led to him being disbarred. So I just took the law that was there for me and I applied it in a way that gave me a slight measure of justice.
That same pursuit of justice is evident in your foundation. You started the Anthony Graves Foundation after your exoneration. What was it that inspired you to do that? And can you tell us a little bit about the mission?
Yeah, what inspired me to do that is, listen, I spent 6,640 days of my life in prison for a crime I knew absolutely nothing about. But more importantly, I was exposed to the inhumanity of our criminal justice system, which is the prison conditions and the way we treat inmates, treat people once we convict them. We treat them as they have no more rights in our country. We isolate them. We call them the worst of the worst, and it allows us to feel comfortable treating them subhumanly. And when I witnessed all of this, I realized that one of the main things that was lacking was this lack of communication between family and the inmates that were incarcerated, attorneys and the inmates that was incarcerated. And it led to a lot of wrong choices on behalf of inmates. And so I decided when I came home, understanding all this, I wanted to create a foundation that addressed this gap between the community, gap in communication between attorneys and clients and families, so that people can have the right kind of information to make the best choices in this system. So I created this project called the Peer Navigator Project. And what I'm doing is training formerly incarcerated individuals how to work alongside criminal defense attorneys to mentor their clients and their family members so that they can hear from someone who have the lived experience, right? Which is the most important thing. They have the lived experience that where they can now build trust and relationships where attorneys can't with their clients, which will lead to the best possible outcomes because building that trust and bridging that communication will help lead to the best results and the best decisions being made in the case for everyone. So that's what we're doing at my foundation, the Peer Navigator Project. I'm just really trying to create a profession for people who are coming back and who wants to contribute to society, but wants to have, want to have something as a career. So, you know, this gives them a career, which I feel like will help destigmatize this ex-felon label that old people. And if we can do that, we can give them more opportunities out here. So I'm just trying to create a profession for second chance citizens to come out here and make a contribution to a system that they once found themselves in by mentoring the clients and mentoring the family members so they can make the best decisions for themselves. So it all comes together.
That's really wonderful. Could you describe, maybe give an example of how that communication between clients and attorneys can be improved?
Yes, because of someone such as myself who have lived the experience, automatically when I come in and talk with your client, there's just a connection there that you can't get with him. And because of that, he and I are allowed to just talk about things that they're going through that the attorney may not be able to really understand. You know, then there's cultural differences and all that. And so because we have that same shared lived experience, there's an automatic trust there that we can build up on, which helps bridge that gap of communication between the attorney and the client, because now the navigator can come in and be the intermediary, and he can make sure that whatever the concerns are with the client that is relayed to the attorney and vice versa. And that for even when the attorney is representing his other clients, the client that I'm representing, the peer navigator over here working with, is trusting the attorney because he's trusting the peer navigator who's now telling him from the lived experience that his attorney is doing good work or that his attorney will show up when he can. Whatever the case may be, it's because of the peer navigator that trust is built. It makes for a smooth relationship between attorney and client, as well as with the family members, because the peer navigator can now reach out to the family members and get and keep them abreast on just the basic language of the criminal justice system, so they can better understand what their loved one is going through, such as the court proceedings, just explaining those things to them, explaining how an arrest should be. Those just so basic things about the legal system can be relayed to the family members as well as the clients. So everybody's getting educated so they can be better informed and make the best decision. And then at the same time, this trusting relationship is being built because two people with lived experiences are there building it together.
In addition to your work with your foundation, you've also spoken across the country and worked with organizations like ACLU and the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty to reform the criminal legal system. What do you think are the top three changes that you would like to see in the legal system to prevent future wrongful convictions like yours?
If I were to summarize the three most important changes I would make in the criminal justice system to prevent wrongful convictions, they will be strengthening the investigation process. Improving the quality and fairness of the investigations is crucial. This includes providing adequate resources and training to law enforcement agents, ensuring evidence is gathered and analyzed accurately, and promoting open-mindedness and exploring all possible leads and suspects. And number two will be enhancing access to quality legal representation. Every individual accused of a crime should have access to competent legal representation throughout the entire legal process. This includes providing adequate funding for public defenders, court-appointed attorneys, improving inner defense system, and ensuring defenders have the resources and support necessary to mount a strong defense. And lastly, I would say, and most importantly to me, is implement safeguards against misconduct. It is essential to establish robust mechanisms to address and prevent misconduct within the criminal justice system. This includes holding prosecutors, law enforcement officers, and other officials accountable for any unethical and illegal action. Implement mandatory recording of interrogation, strengthening rules regarding the disclosure of evidence, and promoting transparency in the system can help prevent wrongful convictions. These changes aim to address systemic flaws that can lead to wrongful convictions and promote fairness, accuracy, and integrity within the criminal justice system. So these are the things that I think should be the most important and should be priority number one, two, and three in terms of addressing issues that can help us prevent wrongful convictions.
And how do you think stories like yours and the 195 other death row exonerees affect people's views on the death penalty? Are there things that you wish more people knew about wrongful convictions?
You know, it's hard to say. I think what happens when they hear our stories, when we share our stories, they are faced with the reality that the death penalty is not infallible, that when we have the death penalty, we run the risk of executing innocent people, someone loved one who doesn't deserve to die. And so I think hearing our stories remind people that we're dealing with human beings and that a system that we put together was created by human beings and that we do make mistakes. Now, what we're going to do about it, I think we're lagging in that area because we now have the evidence to prove that we almost executed almost 200 people that were innocent because they walked off our death row. So, you know, I think why we can't get there is the narrative is wrong. We're always asking the wrong question. We ask them, do you believe in the death penalty? That shouldn't matter. I don't care if you believe in the death penalty. That's between you and whoever you believe in, whoever you serve. The question should be changed. It should be asked them, do you think the death penalty works? And when you have 200 people who walked up the death row who have been found out to be innocent, you can unequivocally say, no, it does not work, that it threatens innocent lives. We have the evidence now. So I think if we start changing the question when we talk to people about the death penalty, people can give you a more accurate response to the question that's being asked other than, do you believe in the death penalty? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we've had it around for a while. It's easy to just say yes. But when you ask, does it work, and you have the evidence to prove that 200 people once was threatened by the state of to be murdered for something they didn't do, then people find it much harder to say they believe in the death penalty or that they support a system that threatens innocent lives. So I think when they hear our stories, when we share our stories across the globe is what I do, people are hit with the reality that we are not dealing with an infallible system.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I'd just like to say, you know, I know that for your listeners, most of them probably are attorneys and they work, probably deal with death penalty work, nonprofit work, dealing with death penalty work. We are a nonprofit, Peer Navigators Project.org, and we want to help you with your clients. You know, attorneys, you guys are great. Nonprofits doing the work around inmates are great. I know and your hearts are in the right place, but there's something that has always been missing that I'm trying to bring to the table, and that is incorporate lived experiences in this holistic approach to your representation of your clients. We want to make sure that they're mentally and emotionally stable while you represent them, because it does no good for you to fight for their life and then they end up crazy before you even get them out. So I know from sitting behind those walls how important it is to have someone that have access to your attorney that you can come that comes down there and know what you actually go through. It's been many times that I will always want someone to know and understand what it is that I'm actually going through instead of just hearing about the X's and O's in my life that kill me or not. I always wanted someone that I could connect with, someone who could go and talk to my attorney about things that was on my mind, but I couldn't get to him or he wouldn't respond to my letters because he was busy. A peer navigator is so important in enhancing effective legal representation. That I implore you guys to reach out and bring us aboard and let us help you represent your clients while you fight for their life. It is a three-tier subscription-based project, and I would hope that you would care enough about your client to understand an holistic approach to representation is the best way to effectively save your client's life.
Thank you. It sounds like a really innovative program, and hopefully this will help spread the word and introduce more people to the work that you're doing.
Yes, hope so.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Do you want to give the web address one more time for the Peer Navigator Project?
Yes, it's the Peer Navigator Project org. And I'm Anthony Grace. Reach out to us. If you have any questions, leave them and we'll respond to them. But I highly recommend that you look us up and allow us the opportunity to help you save your client's life. Because as one attorney told me, it does no good to fight to help bring them home if you bring them home crazy because you didn't pay attention to their emotional, spiritual, and mental needs. I want to be that person to help you in that area that you didn't go to school for. So please reach out.
Great. And if our listeners would like to learn more about the death penalty, they can also visit the DPIC website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. To make sure you never miss an episode of our podcast, you can subscribe to Discussions with DPIC on your podcast app of choice.